Saving Civilization One Tomato at a Time by Bonnie Buckaroo. Chapter 3, Living Off the Land. On rare occasions growing up, I was allowed to go mushrooming with Grandmother Josephine, my mother's mother. The image that sticks in my mind about those excursions is watching her crouched over, moving slowly through the woods, using her gnarled wooden walking stick to deftly move aside the undergrowth, looking for hidden gems to harvest. A woman of her time, she never wore pants, too manly. On our outings, she always wore a long skirt, heavy stockings, and sturdy shoes. To stay warm, she put on a bulky cardigan sweater and her threadbare gray coat along with her ever-present woolen babushka. She was the classic Stara Baba. That term is Eastern European slang used to describe frumpy and wizened old women long past worrying about dressing to attract male attention. I am only here today because both of my grandmothers were forced to flee Lithuania with their husbands when the Bolsheviks invaded after World War I. Both young women came through Ellis Island, and both ended up living in Cleveland. Had my grandmothers stayed in Lithuania, my parents would probably never have met, and they would certainly not have been allowed to marry. Grandmother Josephine was the mayor's daughter, fluent in 7 languages. My father's mother, Bertha, anglicized from Beruta, was a peasant who may or may not have known who her real father was. Yet once both women came here, they both jettisoned their alcoholic husbands and left the Catholic Church. This left them struggling to raise their children alone. With few options available, both women ended up scrubbing the floors in downtown office buildings, trying to make ends meet. America, the great leveler, quickly made both grandmothers equally poor. Foraging for free food helped extend the food budget. But even if it hadn't, mushrooming was in my grandmother's blood. I would typically stay overnight with Grandmother Josephine the night before our mushroom expeditions so we could get the earliest possible start. We would be first at the bus stop in the morning, where we would catch the first of a sequence of Cleveland streetcars or trackless trolleys, those buses attached to overhead wires, that would eventually take us to Gordon Park. We would trudge into the woods when most other people were just beginning to start their day. Grandmother had learned how to identify which mushrooms were safe and which weren't from her mother, back in the old country. I would urge her to share that knowledge with me, but she hesitated to trust someone so young. She would instead point to the ear sowers, the iridescent dragonflies she insisted would sew shut the ears and mouths of pesky little girls who asked too many questions. Grandmother Josephine was secretive about the sites she had identified over the years. Quite frequently, we spent much of our time in the woods circling aimlessly to avoid letting anyone who might be watching identify the precise location of her secret spots. Nothing made her angrier than to find someone had harvested all the mushrooms in one of her places before she got there. On good days, she would fill her basket to the brim with mushrooms of various shapes, sizes, and colors. I no longer remember the Lithuanian names for her favorites, except for the white oysterus, oyster mushrooms, the ones that burst with flavor when sliced thick and pan-fried in a little butter. Earthy, chewy, as satisfying as any cut of meat. Grandmother Josephine viewed food as her primary defense against illness. A health food advocate long before it was fashionable, Grandmother would only drink potato water, the cloudy liquid left over from boiling vegetables. Vitamins, lots of vitamins, she would say, as she retrieved her special jug out of the refrigerator. Try. One try was enough for me. Grandmother loved experimenting with new food combinations she insisted would make me healthier. I was a sickly child plagued by allergies and what I would later learn was celiac disease, and I remember her trying to persuade me to eat Cheerios and milk topped with shredded carrot. I balked. Yuck. Recipe from Betty Crocker, she would insist, though I knew better. It was recipe from Grandmother Josephine. Grandmother always kept a good-sized pantry full of her home-canned fruits, vegetables, and assorted meats, as well as a crock fermenting with homemade sauerkraut. As someone who had struggled to feed a family during the Great Depression, she keenly appreciated the value of preserving food whenever she could. She derived comfort knowing that her larder was filled with row after row of blue ball and cur jars with dull metal tops. Grandmother had a creative streak when it came to canning. One of her favorites involved canning peaches and plums together for an eye-catching treat. Much of what she canned came from foraging. Grandmother's embrace of communism gave her a somewhat flexible attitude toward private property. She would occasionally hide a tomato plant in a vacant lot, even though others might not see it as being as vacant as she did. She would conduct commando raids at dark to gather apples and pears from trees overhanging the sidewalk. "They don't need all of them," she would insist. Grandmother would sometimes take me on foraging expeditions around the neighborhood to find fresh greens to add to our meals. One of her favorites was a weed I learned later was called lamb's quarter, distinguished by its dusty white upper leaves. Food guru Michael Pollan has identified lamb's quarter and purslane as two of the most nutritious plants on earth. Grandmother would mince the lamb's quarter leaves into ribbons and add them to the meat and pea filling she used inside her vieteni, a traditional old-world dumpling. She would also add dry foraged herbs to her homemade sausages. It was hypnotic to watch her slide a natural casing onto the meat grinder bolted to the side of the kitchen table and fill it perfectly as my father cranked the handle. My diet growing up consisted primarily of Lithuanian favorites. On rare occasions, we might venture into Little Italy for authentic spaghetti or splurge on Chinese, but for the most part, we ate traditional artery-clogging Lithuanian dishes. Foremost among them was kugula, a dense potato pudding infused with bacon and bacon grease. Every Lithuanian woman in our neighborhood had her own variation. My grandmother's secret ingredient was farina, a semolina wheat marketed as cream of wheat in this country. Competitive cooking was definitely part of the culture. At every wedding or funeral, women would bring their ethnic specialties to pass. There was no formal judging with blue ribbons, as there was at the county fair, but everybody knew who won. The women would make a show of announcing where they were placing their dishes so that everyone could keep track of which dishes inspired diners to come back for seconds. It wasn't just how quickly the food disappeared, but whether the men smiled or commented. For women who had few avenues to express their creativity, these cook-offs were the local equivalent of today's Top Chef showdowns. Kugula was Grandmother Josephine's top vote-getter. My father's mother, Bertha, was known for her babka, the yellowy egg braid with raisins that she baked for special occasions. This dynamic was replicated in all the ethnic enclaves around the city, as I learned when Grandmother Bertha dragged me to a succession of ethnic weddings: Lithuanian, Polish, Russian, Czech, Slovak, Bosnian, Serbian. No matter the nationality, all of the receptions were held in a church basement or community hall. The revelry revolved around dancing to high-energy polkas and poignant waltzes, fueled by shots of throat-searing whiskey and rich ethnic foods. The wedding reception scene in Michael Cimino's 1978 Oscar-winning film The Deer Hunter could have been shot at any one of a dozen receptions I attended as a child. Grandmother Josephine found the cook-offs so compelling that she would often attend the weddings and funerals of people she didn't know. Like a Broadway critic on opening night, she would critique the ceremony or service and then give us her instant food critic review of the food others had brought. Part of the reason that my grandmothers never wrote down their recipes was the fear that someone would steal their secrets. I also think it was because their recipes changed over time, as they incorporated ingredients they found in local grocery stores in this country that didn't exist back home. I suspect they did not want their peers to know how Americanized they had become. I doubt Lithuania was ever famous for its golden raisins, but over time, at least half of the dark raisins in grandmother's babka became yellow. Though she tried to hide it from me, I once saw grandmother Bertha add some whiskey to the cup of raisins, no doubt part of her secret. I suspect that soaking them in booze plumped them up and gave them a bit more zing. Ethnic purity ultimately did not matter as much as taste, so even the most treasured home country recipes evolved over time to incorporate ingredients from their new home. Food is inextricably bound up with culture and identity. My diet no longer includes many of the foods I was given as a child. Fried bologna and onions on white bread with yellow mustard, anyone? But when times get tough or my stress levels rise, I often crave dishes from my childhood that would make me wrinkle my nose today. When I was feeling ill or blue, Grandmother Josephine immediately offered food as the cure. She kept a cut glass candy dish within reach and was quick to offer me a cellophane-wrapped sweet whenever I needed cheering. Food is love. When I needed sustenance as well as comforting, she often made me her signature dumpling soup. Egg and flour whisked together and dropped by the spoonful into boiling milk, poured into a bowl and seasoned with a little butter and salt. Both my body and my brain want that gluey mess whenever times get tough, even though my celiac disease explains why I always felt even worse afterward. Over the years, we have learned how smell and memory encode together in our brains, which is why an aroma from our childhood can trigger a flood of memories. Proust's Madeleine inspired a torrent of words because the smell of that delicacy caused the memories wired into his brain at the same time to come spilling back out. So it may have been the smell of her famous kugela wafting out of the oven that caused Grandmother Josephine to burst into tears when I asked her what she missed most about Lithuania, the only time I ever saw her cry. "I just wish I could see my mother's grave," she said. After I left, I never got to see her again. Grandmother Josephine almost never talked about the old country. I had expected her to wave away my question. "Don't look back," she would say. "We live here now." So it may have been that the smell of the kugela caused memories to flood back to the point where she couldn't hold back. Grandmother's life was often dotted with unendurable pain, though she fought not to show it. Married at 15 to an older man she barely knew, she found herself alone in a new country, cut off from family and friends. She had three daughters with her first husband, reduced to two when Olga died at 7 or 8 years old from pneumonia. My mother once told me that losing Olga made Grandmother realize that she had to do more to take control of her own life. That experience appeared to steel her to withstand the stigma and shame of divorcing her husband because of his drinking. The next time, Grandmother married for love. Her second husband, Bill, my mother's father, was a small man, less than 5 feet tall. Though he was smart, his accent was thick, so he was doomed to a grimy life in the foundry. He drank to cope, to celebrate, and to quench his anger at a world filled with bigger men he felt mocked him. Ultimately, though she loved him, my grandmother divorced him too. My mushroom hunting forays to Gordon Park with my grandmother ended abruptly when I was 8 years old. Immediately after, my grandfather went to Gordon Park and put a belt around his neck, tied it to a tree branch, and hanged himself. Two unsuspecting teenage boys out for a walk found him. Grandmother Josephine would never go there again. Part of the blame rests with his alcoholism. I remember him tucking a flask of whiskey into his lunch pail each morning when he lived with us when I was a child. My parents rented him a bedroom, not out of love, but because they needed the money. I loved him without reservation, perhaps because we seemed so much alike. He and I shared the same birthday, May 1st, and we were both left-handed. He would also do things with me that made me feel special. One of my happiest childhood memories was when we made a birdhouse together. He showed me how to melt metal to make the lead sinkers we would use to hold down the fishing line when we fished together off the pier at Gordon Park. Yet his drinking frightened me too. A bad cold once kept him in bed for days, too sick to drink, and that threw him into delirium tremens, the DTs. My parents forbade me from going into his bedroom, but I could hear him through the door, raving about spiders in his bed and electric wires under his skin. At some point, his outburst became so frightening that I crept into the room to see if I could help. I remember him thrashing and shaking, pale and sweaty, almost buried in a pile of twisted bedsheets. I also remember him looking at me without recognizing me, so I quietly crept back out. The chaos caused by his alcoholism ultimately persuaded my parents that it was better to forego the income than to deal with the constant embarrassment. Over the years, his drinking escalated to the point where he often spent at least one night a week in the drunk tank. He would receive his pay from the foundry on Friday and head to the bar. Like many men of small stature, he became increasingly belligerent the more he drank. He would frequently pick a fight with someone far larger, and inevitably, when the police arrived, they would haul him to jail for the night for being the instigator. I remember my parents' shame as the quote-unquote paddy wagon would pull up to the house on Sunday morning, and Granddad would stumble out in rumpled clothes, reeking of booze, sweat, and vomit. The day he ended up thrown out of our house began with him lurching past the churchgoers on the sidewalk Sunday morning as he made his way inside. As he frequently did, he then locked himself in the bathroom to take a long soak in the tub, nursing both a hangover and some bruises from his latest altercation. But this time, he fell asleep so soundly that nothing we did could rouse him. After an hour or so, my father started knocking on the door. Soon my need to use the bathroom became urgent, and I began dancing in the hallway. My father tried knocking and yelling to no avail. Eventually, he was forced to put a ladder up to the side of the house and climb in the bathroom window to rouse him. A small crowd gathered on the sidewalk to watch the spectacle, laughing and jostling each other. For my parents, that public humiliation in front of the neighbors was too painful to ignore. Like many people with little money, their self-worth depended on maintaining their dignity. Giving busybody neighbors something to snicker about was unforgivable, and Grandfather had to go. When I returned from school the next day, Grandfather was gone, banished without any chance for me to say goodbye. A week later, I thought I saw him standing at the end of our block when I was playing in the front yard. I asked my mother if I could go down there to check, but she shooed me inside and kept me indoors for days afterwards. A few weeks after that, he was dead, and I found myself at my first funeral. No one would tell me much about what had happened, and conversations about his death stopped cold whenever I would enter the room. But at the funeral home, when I approached the casket, a distant cousin taunted me. "Your mother and dad shouldn't have kicked him out," he whispered. "They killed him." "What are you talking about?" I asked. "Your granddad hung himself. They had to lie to get him into the Catholic cemetery." I remember being taken home in a cab after I began crying and throwing up. My mother vented her frustration by yelling at me for making a scene, for making her miss the funeral, and for costing her the price of the taxi ride home. If food is love, then trauma can rob you of your appetite. Grandmother Josephine had divorced him, but she didn't stop loving him. His death and the manner in which it happened caused her to lose her taste for mushroom hunting in the park where he died. She simply could not bear to go there, not knowing which tree he might have used. My mother would experience choking dreams for at least a month before and after the anniversary of his death each year. She never again wore a necklace. For years, I would gag whenever I smelled funeral flowers. Grandfather's death was an early lesson that not all stories have a happy ending, and that sorrow can sometimes leave an aching inside so big that no comfort food can fill it.